Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the RevThem Rule of Law podcast. In this interview, our assistant editor Gaurav Mukherjee talks to Nick Barber to discuss democratic backsliding in the UK, the role of courts in protecting democratic procedures, and the state of parliamentary sovereignty in the face of Brexit and COVID-19. Nick Barber is Professor of Constitutional Law and Theory at the University of Oxford and a non-practicing barrister and member of Middle Temple. His published work includes the books The Constitutional State in 2011, Principles of Constitutionalism, published in 2018, and The United Kingdom Constitution from 2021. He was founding editor of the UK Constitutional Law blog, and he was a co-author with Jeff King and Tom Hickman of the blog post that sparked the seminal litigation in the Miller case.
Thanks, Nick, for joining us. And I want to start off by asking you whether you think democratic backsliding is the correct framing to think about the changes in law, the breakdown in convention, and the alteration of public discourse around the rule of law in the UK. And I'm asking you this because I'm wondering whether there are certain changes in law and policy that worry you. And what are the kinds of changes that may be constitutionally permissible, but maybe objectionable to progressives? Is there a way in which we can tell these two apart?
Well, thank you. That's a great opening question, a very challenging one too. So this idea of democratic backsliding is the idea of the moment. Everybody seems to be writing about it and on it. But of course, what backsliding is often hard to pin down. And I think that maybe democratic backsliding goes beyond mere changes to constitutional structures. Just it goes beyond altering the role of the courts or affecting the way in which legislators operate. I think democratic backsliding is more of a cultural event than an institutional event. It's a shift in the way our expectations of government and our expectations of our leaders have moved over time, and the way in which that shift might push away from a model in which leaders are bound by law, bound by the constitution, and are responsive to the whole of the population. So I think this is a shift towards maybe ruleless leadership, and a leadership that only speaks to a subsection of the citizenry. So if we take democratic backsliding as being a cultural issue, can we see that in the United Kingdom's constitutional structures? And I think the answer is in two stages. The first, a pessimistic answer, and the second, a far more optimistic answer. So pessimistically, I think that if you look at the leadership of our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, you might well feel a little depressed. There has been a real sea change in what it means to be a leader in UK politics. Boris has, through his actions and through his pronouncements, adopted a very different approach to being Prime Minister, to being a leader, to that you'd see on behalf of, say, Theresa May or David Cameron or Tony Blair or any of the past Prime Ministers. That is worrying. So what is this shift? Well, I think Boris is somebody who regards rules as things that you navigate around or you break if you think you can get away with them. Whereas previous Prime Ministers were regarded themselves as fettered by rules, even if they could evade them. And we see this in a whole host of things that Boris has done. Perhaps the most prominent is the Partygate scandal, which I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of, partly because it's just hilariously funny. And I'm sure that around the world, people are having a good laugh at this. So during the period of lockdown, when everybody was told to stay at home, wash their hands and basically see as few people as possible, it turns out that in Downing Street, there are a whole series of parties being conducted with drinks and quizzes and frolicking in the Downing Street garden. Now, at one level, this isn't very serious at all. In terms of breaking the law, this is at the same level, perhaps, as speeding or parking on a double yellow line. But on another level, I think it's quite important, because what it shows is that in Downing Street, Boris looked on those rules as being rules for other people and not for him. And he was willing to break the rules, thinking that he wouldn't be found out. And those around him were prepared to accept him breaking those rules. So the first thing, Partygate. But Sandy, alongside that, you've got a whole host of instances where Boris has also shown himself willing to act contrary to the conventions that usually construct power within the constitution. So it's willing to break those rules that prime ministers in the past have accepted bind them. For example, we have the example of Peter Cruddas, who was appointed to the House of Lords against the advice of the House of Lords Appointment Commission. So the House of Lords doesn't have any legal power to issue any binding advice, but in the past, prime ministers have, with more or less reluctance, accepted the rulings of that body, and Boris didn't. Similarly, when Priti Patel was accused of violating the ministerial code, Boris asked his standards advisor to review her conduct. The standards advisor reviewed the conduct, said that she'd broken the ministerial code by bullying one of her civil servants, and Boris just rejected that. He rejected the decision of the findings of that report. Again, previous prime ministers might not have liked the outcome of the reviews they established into breach of the ministerial code, but they would have accepted it and regarded it as being a convention that they were stuck with the decisions of their reviewers. We could add to this the prorogation case a couple of years ago, where Boris prorogued the House of Parliament to stop them interfering with Brexit. We might talk about that later on, because the court stepped in to stop that prorogation. There were also, back in 2019, even suggestions that Boris might be willing to advise the Queen to refuse to give assent to legislation if that legislation went against his policies, which is unheard of, I think, almost in modern politics. So this is an example, perhaps, of a form of democratic backsliding, that Boris Johnson no longer regarded himself as being fettered by constitutional norms in the way that his predecessors regarded himself as being fettered. And before I can go on to the more optimistic side, this is really serious. One of the things we don't think about perhaps enough in constitutional theory and constitutional scholarship is the way in which the interpretation that leaders give to their roles is in itself a constitutional act. So when you have a leader who is saying, make it plain to the public that if he can dodge rules, if he can break rules with impunity, he will. That's not just, as it were, a problem in terms of him and his leadership. That's a statement about how powerful people relate to rules all the way down the constitutional structure. There's that great proverb, isn't there, that fish rot from the head down. Well, of course, the same is true of constitutional structures. If you've got a prime minister, if you've got a president, if you've got a leader who flouts constitutional rules and presents the image that those of us who abide by the rules are suckers, then that will percolate all the way down the structure and change the way in which people in general look on the constitution. So this is constitutionally significant as well as legally significant. Now, I can see the distress in your face. So this is worrying. Yeah, this is scary stuff. But I think there's a second side to this story. So Boris has pushed this very unusual form of leadership in the British Constitution, one that challenges many of our constitutional fundamentals. But there's been an awful lot of pushback against him. So I think Boris's position now is much more tenuous than it was when he took office a couple of years ago. Indeed, one of the oddities about Boris Johnson's government is it feels to me anyway, like a minority government, a perilous government, a government that's living from day to day, a government that's in constant crisis. But in fact, Boris has got a huge majority. He won a landslide back in Christmas, not long ago. So whilst at one level we might worry about democratic backsliding in the UK, and we might be justified in worrying because Boris has changed the norms that underpin leadership, I don't think that he's been successful in that change. I think that a consequence of that pressure is that he's weakened his position, he's weakened his government, and sooner or later he's going to pay a price, because it's very hard to imagine Boris now taking the Conservative Party into the next general election. So I think that you might, if you were to analyse democratic backsliding in the United Kingdom, you might see this as a failed attempt at democratic backsliding. The pressures were there, the movement was there, but there's been resistance, not just from the opposition, but from within the Conservative Party to this conduct. Now, the other question you asked me then, Gaurav, was how can we tell the good from the bad? And that is fiendishly difficult, isn't it? That is, again, a question of the outer limits of what's politically acceptable. And I don't think there is any very easy way of distinguishing the good from the bad in terms of constitutional change. So all those questions that surround democratic backsliding, the role of the judges, the role of the legislature, the role of the leaders, these are all politically loaded questions. And politicians in good faith are entitled and should take positions on those issues. So it must be the case that the courts should be subject to political review from time to time. Politicians are entitled to be interested in, are judges doing their job properly? Is the court system working effectively? Do they agree with the outcome of the cases that the judges are producing? They're entitled to shift the law, of course. I think the lodestone for testing whether or not the changes proposed by the politicians are on the acceptable side or on the unacceptable side is by thinking about this through the lens of integration, by which I mean the lens of thinking of the way in which a constitution draws people together and draws people in to the constitutional order. We have to make sure that the changes that are made to the courts and to the legislatures are such that they don't imperil the capacity of our constitutional institutions to answer and resolve disputes and disagreements within the constitution. We don't push those disputes outside of the constitutional structures. And frankly, a wise politician, no matter how power hungry and power mad, should realize that having a legislature that's able to accommodate disagreement, having courts that people by and large regard as fair and legitimate institutions, these are assets for the constitution and assets for him or her as a leader, and are things worth preserving. So I think that's the key test. Do your changes imperil the capacity of constitutional institutions to effectively contain and resolve disagreement, or are these changes ones that allow that process to continue?
Let's talk a bit about one of these constitutional institutions, which can, in some cases, help arrest democratic backsliding. So how do you see the role of courts in this kind of a process? Have UK courts usually engaged in the kind of counter-majoritarian functions that courts in other jurisdictions are set to perform?
Well, that's a tricky question, isn't it? So it's a hot debate, I think, in constitutional scholarship at the moment, how powerful courts can be. And to draw a phrase from another another area, there's the nightmare and the noble dream, as it were, isn't there? The noble dream is that the courts can do everything, and we just need to stop worrying and trust the judges. And the nightmare is that the courts can do nothing, and we should give way to despair. I think the first thing I'd say about courts as guardians against democratic backsliding is don't put too much faith in the courts. Don't put all your money on the courts. So the courts are a very weak constitutional institution in many ways. They're weak because, of course, of their institutional structure, first of all. They're case-based. So courts only get to act when a case comes before them. And that means that they're not really well placed to sort of undertake a general roving role reviewing what goes on within the constitution. So we talked about Boris Johnson's antics earlier on. A number of those come touch on the courts. So the courts get involved peripherally, but very rarely can the courts get involved directly. So first of all, the case-based method of the court limits its capacity to fight back against democratic backsliding. And secondly, the lack of enforcement capacity in the courts limits their capacity too. So as lawyers, we tend to imagine that when the court hands down a judgment, some sort of magic occurs and it automatically becomes effective. And often it does, but it does because in the background there are police and bailiffs and other executive institutions that go along and enforce the rulings of the courts. Courts depend almost entirely on the executive to make their rulings effective. And that means that the court's capacity to, as it were, control what the executive does is really limited. The court does have some capacity to affect executive action. It's not completely powerless, but if you have an executive that's hell-bent on fettering the courts, there are real sort of limits to what the court can accomplish. So two institutional constraints that mean we shouldn't be too optimistic about what the courts can do. the case-based method of the court, and secondly, that the court depends on the executive for its effect, the effective functioning of the courts and the effective carrying forwards of its decisions. A second set of reasons why you shouldn't put too much weight on the courts here is that democratic backsliding is, I think, a cultural phenomenon, one that is ultimately grounded in the population. And if you want to stop democratic backsliding, the way to do it is to persuade people in the political arena that what's going on is problematic and unattractive. The courts have a very limited capacity to shape the broader culture, the broader constitutional culture in our society. It's not nothing. They can do things. There are things they can do. But primarily, if you want to fight democratic backsliding, the way to do it is through the political structures of the Constitution. And if the court does too much, if the court goes too far in being assertive in these contexts, I think there's often a risk that the court loses its authority, it loses its perceived legitimacy in the community, as it's seen by some in the community as being a roadblock or in opposition to the government. So it's forced itself, it's drawn back into the raw political debate that it should be trying to stand above. And more worrying still, once it's drawn into that political debate, it can then be presented as the scapegoat by the executive. The executive can say, oh, if only it weren't for the courts, we would be able to accomplish Brexit, to work with these annoying judges getting in the way. And then going back to our earlier discussion, the court loses its capacity to play that role as a resolver of disputes, as a mediator of disputes. So the court needs to remember that it has to maintain popular support for its position. It's a weak institution that relies on general acceptance and general supports, and that limits how radical it can be in pushing it back against democratic decay. Now, having said that, if that's, as it were, the nightmare side, there is some truth as well to the noble dream side. Courts aren't powerless. Courts do have some capacity to push back. And I don't think we need to sort of side with John Hart Ely and think that the only thing courts can do is protect process. But one of the things courts can do extremely well is protect the process of the Constitution by making sure that the right processes have to be undertaken, have to be gone through. And I think that's what you see in the Miller cases in the United Kingdom. So the first Miller case, for example, insisted or decided that it wasn't possible for the United Kingdom government to take us out of the European Union by executive action. There had to be a statute passed by Parliament before that could be undertaken, before that move could be undertaken. And whilst it was politically controversial, I think it was much less politically controversial than, heaven forfend, if the courts had stepped in to say we couldn't leave the European Union. What the court was saying was, here is the process by which it can be done. And it's a process which prioritises the democratic branch, the Constitution. It puts weight on the democratic branch, the Constitution. Similarly, in the second Miller case, the prorogation case, where the court stepped in to stop the executive proroguing, suspending Parliament for an extremely long period of time. Again, the court can say, well, this isn't we, the judges, imposing our political views on the population. This is the judges protecting Parliament and enabling Parliament to do its role. So if you're looking for something that courts can do to prevent democratic backsliding, I think looking at those processes might be a good place to look. Courts are well placed to shore up legislatures. They are well placed probably also to shore up the rights of citizens to participate in democratic processes. And I think this is what the British courts have tended to do. They have tended to side with Parliament rather than opposing the executive. They're Parliament focused rather than executive opposing. Now you ask me, are courts in the UK counter-majoritarian? Do we see counter-majoritarian decisions being produced by the courts? Well, I don't know. Counter-majoritarian is a funny term, isn't it? Because almost invariably, everything that the court does, lots of people oppose. And given the court often has to make decisions that people don't like, it might be quite common for courts to hand down counter-majoritarian decisions. I think the key is for the court to avoid the impression that it is on one side or the other of a political debate. So sometimes the majority that's against it will be one sort of coalition of groups. On other times, it will be a different coalition of groups. And it's quite important the court sort of not always be batting for one side or the other. Of course, in the United Kingdom, since 2000, we've got the Human Rights Act and we've got the devolution legislation. And those are instances where the court is pushed to a certain extent into the political realm and has to make decisions that will upset some political groups. But I think by and large, the United Kingdom courts have done that pretty well. And the amount of anguish and opposition that's been produced has been muted, not absent, but muted.
It's so interesting that a raft of legislation comes after the tenure of Lord Reed and the difference in Lord Reed's tenure from Baroness Hill's tenure. So I'm curious about how you think about the Judicial Review at Courts Bill, which is currently moving through Parliament. And how different is it from previous attempts that heads of state in the United Kingdom have made to engage with the judiciary? And a number of PMs have done this, including Tony Blair, Dave Cameron, Theresa May. And is there something vastly different about this bill? Is there something there that scares you?
I'm afraid, Gaurav, I've only got a very boring answer to this one. So firstly, you're right to say that that all politicians, all prime ministers, all executives since the dawn of time have had to engage with the courts. And there's nothing remarkable or surprising about the government producing legislation that shapes the way courts do their jobs, that creates tribunals, that manages the relationship between tribunals and courts. So the bare fact that the politicians are interested in that, I think it's not just unobjectionable, it's good. I want my politicians to be concerned about the administration of justice in the United Kingdom. Now, your next question is, well, is what's going on now materially different to what's gone on in the past? And I'm afraid I don't think it is. So there are two big debates that have been raised by the Judicial Review and Courts Bill, two areas of dispute. One area of dispute is the creation of the potential for quashing orders that are prospective only. So the bill will give the judges the power to quash executive acts, but either suspend that annulment for a period of time, or quash decisions that are made after this point. So not ones that have been made before that. That case. I can't really see why that's causing so much worry and anguish, because all this does is give judges the capacity to do that. So after this bill, if this bill becomes law, the courts will have the capacity to issue prospective quashing orders. They won't have to issue those orders. It'll be down to the discretion of the judges. And I'm sure that we can all imagine situations in which prospective quashing orders make a lot of sense.
It's also pretty common in the common law world. There are other courts that do this routinely.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure we all remember the Canadian Language Act, where if there hadn't been the capacity to issue prospective orders, then all of the laws of one of the provinces of Canada would have been declared a nullity. So this seems to me to be a sensible measure. The second area of controversy in the Judicial Review and Courts Bill is provisions that regulate the relationship between the courts and tribunals, and which seek to try to restrict the capacity for judicial review of tribunal decisions. Now, first of all, this is not novel. These sort of provisions restricting the capacity of courts to review what tribunals do go right back to the dawn of tribunals. You can go, you know, when dinosaurs stalked the earth, as soon as tribunals came into existence, Parliament was trying to create structures that stopped the courts from interfering with the tribunals. And we have at least 50 or 60 years worth of history of Parliament producing rules that restrict the capacity of courts to exercise judicial review over tribunals, and the courts circumventing those statutory rules to institute review of those tribunals. Now, when you look at the actual provisions in the Judicial Review and Courts Bill, they seem to me to be reasonably modest. So although they are trying to limit the capacity of the courts to review the decisions of the upper tribunal, they explicitly permit review of those decisions if they're made in bad faith or in violation of natural justice processes. So there still will be a sort of an outlying capacity for the courts to exercise judicial review. And just think how flexible those terms are, bad faith and natural justice. Those are flexible enough to capture most really problematic decisions. I can imagine that a court might say that bad faith, what bad faith means is decisions that look like they're made in bad faith. So decisions that are severely adrift, that look wildly irrational, perhaps the court would be able to say, well, that appears to be in bad faith, and that's enough for us to be warranted, to be permitted then to exercise judicial review over these decisions under this provision. And even if all that didn't work, there's no way that the Judicial Review and Courts Bill can stop the ultimate get out, the ultimate workaround for a very eager court that wants to review the decisions of the upper tribunal, the workaround that was seen in the Annis Minnick case, the workaround that was seen in Privacy International, which is to challenge the very idea that a decision has been made. So if the upper tribunal made a really weird announcement, the courts could still say, well, the provisions in the Judicial Review and Courts Bill don't apply here because we're just declaring that no decision has been reached because the decision of the upper tribunal flouted law. Yeah, it was so bad, it wasn't even a decision. And so there's still that capacity, I think, left open to the judges. So maybe I'm being too sanguine. Maybe I should be more worried. But it seems to me that the Judicial Review and Courts Bill isn't something we should be panicking about. This is a part of a long history of the courts, parliament and tribunals, that relationship being navigated. And it's not even the most extreme form of restriction on the capacity of the courts to oversee what the tribunals do. Oh, and we shouldn't forget as well, when I say tribunals, you might still have that impression that these are basically executive bodies. The upper tribunal is essentially a court. It's got a judge who sits at its head. It looks very much like a court for all practical purposes. So I don't think we should be alarmed that Parliament wants to leave a lot of discretion and autonomy to the upper tribunal.
It's interesting how these debates track some of the debates in India with respect to the ouster of the jurisdictions of the ordinary courts when it comes to the tribunals. And courts in India have always said that the ordinary courts, the high courts and the Supreme Court, should always have the final word and the final say. So, and of course, this follows a long history of the Indian judiciary zealously guarding what it seems like, what it thinks of as its own sort of realm. But let's move now to a slightly broader question and a slightly unfair one, I think, which is, what do you think are the kind of similarities and divergences between the phenomenon of democratic backsliding in the UK and the rest of the world? Of course, if you want to narrow it down a little bit, which might be useful, we can take, for example, I mean, the relationship between the executive and the judiciary, and think about the reaction to Miller. So while the judgment was discursively contested in the UK from all quarters, there appeared to be no indication that it wouldn't be followed. Now, this is very different from what's happened in certain cases in Poland and Hungary, where both national and supranational court rulings have been ignored. So how do you see the divergences and the similarities?
Well, that's a very difficult question. Well, before I answer that, just you talk about India a second there. Just one thought on that. Here's a really interesting thought, I think. There is a certain legal logic to the proposition that the courts have to have the final say about the decisions of tribunals. And the courts have to have the final say because ultimately they have the final say about the content of the law. And if the tribunals are handing down decisions that have legal effect, then sooner or later the courts inevitably are put in a position where they have to say, yes, there was a legal act by the tribunal. That actually happened. And I don't think there's any way, actually, through constitutional engineering, that you can stop courts playing that role. They can play that role by saying there was a decision, but we can't review it. But they can't play that role by saying we can't even review whether or not there was a decision. That, as a matter of legal logic, they are compelled. They must be able to do. So I think they're sort of interesting. So the structure of the Constitution is such that you can't completely protect tribunals from review by courts. It's logically impossible, I think. Now, you asked me a really, really difficult question about the comparison of democratic backsliding in the UK compared to the rest of the world. And I think that's a question you should answer rather than me, Gareth, because you're a far better place to answer it. My immediate thoughts are perhaps the problem is less acute in the United Kingdom, maybe because we have historically had less of a role of the courts in politics. So the role of the courts has always been much more constrained than it has been in other systems. So we've never had strong form judicial review in the United Kingdom. And that's meant that the courts have always been in a subservient role in some ways, in constitutional terms, to Parliament. The Human Rights Act, the courts can issue a declaration of incompatibility saying that a law runs contrary to the Convention rights, but the courts can't strike it down. That then goes back to Parliament, and Parliament could, if it wished, decide it wants to stick with the law. And maybe we've been lucky, but that's been quite a healthy discipline, because it means that Parliament isn't put in a position where they can rail against the courts striking down a statute. Parliament actually has to decide, well, do we want to keep this incompatible statute with all the sort of obrium that's attached to it, or do we want to make the change? And put in that position, parliamentarians have decided in every single case, I think, of a Section 4 declaration of compatibility, that they will make the change. So because the weight is on Parliament, because Parliament is the top dog in the Constitution, perhaps we haven't built up that sense of tension between the political and the legal side of the Constitution that maybe we've seen elsewhere. And the culture in the United Kingdom of democracy, of the importance of Parliament, of Parliament as being the place where these decisions have been made, I think has been resilient, even in the face of Boris Johnson's antics that we talked about earlier on. So maybe we've been lucky, perhaps so far, in the United Kingdom, that we've managed to maintain a vibrant democratic culture in the face of some pressures. And it's that, I think, that you need to foster and protect if you want to fence back against a democratic decay. Final point I'll make is it's really important to the executive to maintain confidence in Parliament and in the courts. So sometimes I wonder if some of this democratic decay is short-sightedness on the part of the executive, rather than the executive Machiavellianly seizing the moment to aggrandize its power. Because if you're a prime minister, if you're a leader, you want people to obey the laws that you produce. And the way in which you get people to obey the laws and accept your decisions is by having those laws voted on in a parliament that's regarded as containing different views and resolving disagreements. It's by having your laws interpreted and applied by courts that are regarded as independent, that are regarded as slightly to one side of the state. And I think that ultimately has been the consideration that's perhaps held back politicians in the United Kingdom from the sort of antics that we've perhaps seen elsewhere. It's self-interest as well as virtue.
And this brings me to the question of parliamentary sovereignty. And one of the first things that I learned as a first-year law student in India was that the UK Parliament is sovereign. And it is sovereign to pass a law that could outlaw blue-eyed babies. And this is a metaphor which I never fully understood why this metaphor traveled so far and why. But you have long argued that parliamentary sovereignty is largely a trope in the public law literature that isn't particularly true, either as a descriptive or an analytic claim about the UK. Now, in light of the majority that the current government holds in Parliament, do you see the idea of executive sovereignty as being the central problem of constitutional thinking in the UK today? And what are some of the other horizontal institutions apart from courts that can check democratic backsliding, and how well have they performed?
That's the difficult questions. So I suppose I'll answer that in two parts. So firstly, parliamentary sovereignty and my scepticism of it. I mean, my scepticism of parliamentary sovereignty stems from, I suppose, this question, which is, what is parliamentary sovereignty? So you often hear people talking about parliamentary sovereignty, and blue-eyed babies are wheeled in, and all manner of other things are brought before us. But there's often a singular lack of clarity about what people understand parliamentary sovereignty to be in the first place. So before we answer the question, is Parliament still sovereign or not? Is parliamentary sovereignty still a feature of the United Kingdom Constitution? We really have to have a very firm grasp on what parliamentary sovereignty actually means. And up until the 1990s, I think parliamentary sovereignty was very, very simple and very, very clear. Parliamentary sovereignty was a legal rule which said whatever the Queen in Parliament enacts a statute is law. And if you'd asked Dicey or Jennings or Houston or Wade or any of the vast sort of, you know, truckload of constitutional scholars writing in the 50s, 60s or 30s or 40s, they would have agreed with that statement. Parliamentary sovereignty was a legal rule about the priority of sources in the Constitution and the priority of instruments within that source. Now, my argument is that as a result of our membership of the European Union and the decision of the British courts, in particular in the Factotum decision, that rule disappeared. We had a change in the way in which the sources of the Constitution were hierarchically ordered and the instruments of the Constitution related to each other. In particular, the idea that the most recent statute of Parliament is always supreme disappeared. Now, I could talk all day about that. Now, and on one level, this is quite boring, I think, as a conversation. But it's boring because parliamentary sovereignty is fundamentally not a very exciting issue. It's about the technicalities of a particular rule that developed in the United Kingdom in the early part of the 20th century and which disappeared in the face of the rise of the European Union as part of the United Kingdom's constitution. The second question you asked me sort of connects in with that, which is asking me about the place of Parliament in the constitution more generally. Because even if Parliament is no longer sovereign, it may yet still be supreme in the case that it's the highest constitutional institution that we have, in that its pronouncements can always be made law, even though it might have to jump through a few hoops before that's effective. And the challenge you made to me there was, maybe it's no longer true to say that Parliament is supreme. Perhaps we should say that the executive is supreme now and Parliament's day has passed. And this picks up on that glorious phrase of Lord Hailsham 30 or 40 years ago, that we have in the United Kingdom an elective dictatorship. We have an election once every 4 or 5 years. A government is formed, but the government can then do pretty much what it wants. And the evidence for this is how often is the executive defeated in Parliament? Very, very rarely. So the executive drafts legislation. The legislation goes before Parliament. Parliament almost invariably votes for that legislation. And any amendments that occur to the legislation are done with the executive's approval. And the whips are often held up as being the villains of the piece here. So the government has officers who are called whips. Their job is to go into Parliament and to pressure and encourage backbench MPs to toe the party line, to vote for government. So when we hear descriptions of the United Kingdom Constitution, they're often quite pessimistic about democracy. Parliament is in decline. Parliament is the poodle, the lapdog of the executive, meekly following the executive's rulings. But I'm not sure that's right. I think that's a mistaken interpretation of the United Kingdom Constitution. Why? Well, I think what it's missing out on is the extent to which the Prime Minister is dependent on Parliament. So the Prime Minister is, of course, the person who commands the support of the largest number of MPs in the House of Commons. And that means that the House of Commons gets to pick who the Prime Minister is. The Prime Minister then selects his or her ministers, but of course, it's still the Commons that is there in the background. The Prime Minister has to make sure that he maintains the support of the House of Commons. So indirectly, the House of Commons also gets to select the cabinet. And if you look at cabinets, they're often a balance of different elements of the party to ensure the Prime Minister maintains its support. And if the Prime Minister loses the support of the Commons, he or she can be out of a job at any point during the time of the government. So the Prime Minister's position, the executive position, the government's position as the political branch of the executive is quite perilous. It depends on the support of Parliament. Now, going back to those whips, one of the jobs the whips do is they go from the front bench to the back bench to try and pressure backbench MPs to vote in the way that ministers and the Prime Minister want. But they have a second job. They go from backbench MPs to government ministers and the Prime Minister, and they keep the government informed about the views and the wishes and the worries of the MPs in the House of Commons. And when this is working well, and it usually does work pretty well, what this means is government never proposes legislation that isn't going to have the support of a majority of MPs in the House of Commons, because the government already knows before it puts down that legislation that it's got the support it needs to get that legislation through. This is a small example, but back when David Cameron was Prime Minister, in the early days of his government, there was a proposal that the forests in the United Kingdom be privatised. We'd sell off the forests. And this was about as popular as sort of a serious disease with the Conservative backbenchers. You know, nobody liked this idea. And this proposal just disappeared overnight. And it disappeared overnight because David Cameron mooted it. The whips went and spoke to backbench MPs. Cameron realised that even though he and Nick Clegg had a majority of MPs in the Commons, he didn't have enough MPs to get this through, and the measure was never proposed. So I put it to you, Gaurav, that we talk of an executive dictatorship. We've got this idea of the executive dominating Parliament, but in fact what we have is Parliament dominating the executive. And the outcome of that looks the same. It's the same. You have the same symptoms. The reason that Parliament isn't rejecting legislation on a regular basis is because the executive already knows what it can get through Parliament before it puts those bills before the chamber.
If I can just ask you something. Yeah. So would your response change if you think about the range of legislation and executive orders relating to the pandemic that were introduced absolutely at the last minute and voted on, and MPs were rarely ever given enough time to thoroughly scrutinize many of these executive orders? And in some cases, they were delegated legislation. But do you think that your response is slightly different when it comes to lawmaking around the pandemic?
That's a good point. And I think there was a brief moment, maybe a moment of 6 months or so, when Parliament was unable to sit. The executive had to act, and the executive was acting pretty freely. I mean, it was acting under pre-existing legal structures. So it was acting through structures that Parliament had created. But because this was a crisis, I think it is fair to say that the legal niceties of those pieces of legislation really were put to one side. It was a case where the executive could just act. Two qualifications to that. First qualification was this was during a global pandemic, where a crisis that we've never really seen, and hopefully never will see again. So there was that brief moment in which the political rules of the game changed. Second answer is, of course, then the government was accountable for what it had done when Parliament came back again. It wasn't that all of that was just written off. We now see Parliament scrutinising what the government did during that period, asking whether the rules, for example, on the contracts that were given for personal protective equipment were done properly, examining whether the rules introduced were suitable. So I think it would be a mistake to look on that period of COVID as being, as it were, revealing the truth of the United Kingdom Constitution. This was a moment at which an exceptional crisis hit, and the constitutional structures, I think, did shift to accommodate that crisis. And now we've returned to something that's more like normality. If you want to see a moment of constitutional crisis when I think you did see the underlying structure of the United Kingdom's constitution exposed, go back to 2019 and the first part of Boris Johnson's government, where Boris was a minority government trying to get Brexit through. And then you really did see the way in which government had to look for votes the negotiations that usually went on behind the scenes between conservative backbenchers and the government were suddenly made public. We saw that negotiation happening in real time. The negotiations with opposition MPs, indeed, to get measures through, we were exposed. So I think if you're looking for a crisis that exposes the truth of the British constitution, the United Kingdom constitution, that's the moment to look at. The 2019 government, when all those internal negotiations became external.
Let me, with the final question, I want to ask you about how you see your role as a public law scholar. So you were one of the authors of the blog post that is said to have triggered the litigation in Miller. So did that experience change how you saw the role of the public law scholar in pushing back against certain processes of democratic backsliding?
I think public law scholars as scholars have, we do have a role to play, but again, it's a limited role. So I think backsliding is a social phenomenon, and there's a limit to what you'd expect public law academics to achieve. It's not nothing. What is the, I suppose, the role of the public law academic? It's changing very quickly, and it's changed very dramatically. And the thing that has changed it, I think, is the thing we're using right now, the internet. So when I first became an academic back in the late 1990s, I mean, the internet was there, but it was in relative infancy. If you wanted to comment on a case or discuss some constitutional event, you wrote your article, you sent it off to a journal which sat on it for a few months, and then if you were lucky, it got published 6 or 7 months after you wrote it. The internet has given us the capacity to comment on events in real time, and I think that does shift how we should regard our roles as our academics, because one of the things we can now do, one of the roles we can now play, is as interrogators of the court and interrogators of a parliament. We can provide a particular type of scrutiny that perhaps those who aren't legally skilled would struggle to provide. Now, you focus on democratic backsliding. We have a role to play there. But moreover, perhaps more importantly, I think our role should be to make the judge's life miserable. So the judges and the courts exercise considerable power. They develop the law, they hand down decisions in particular cases. And this type of power is mediated through the language of the law, through case law, through legal reasoning, that means it's quite difficult for people who don't have legal training to engage with. Now, most lawyers are, as it were, it's problematic for them to criticize judges because they might appear before the judge next week. But us as academic lawyers, we're really quite well placed to exercise scrutiny over what the judges are doing. So I think what I would, and I don't know if this answers your question or answers a different question, maybe, what I would encourage academic lawyers to do is to be more critical of judges and more willing to stand up and examine judicial reasoning on behalf of a public that perhaps lack the skills to do that. So we should act as the bridge between the public and the judges, and we should be willing to be critical of the judges when we're undertaking that task.
Well, wonderful. Speaking truth to judicial power as a central role of the public law academic. Thank you very much, Nick, for this wonderful conversation. It's been great, and we'll hopefully see you soon.
I hope so. Thank you very much. It's been great fun.